This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross, who's off this week. Years ago, when I drove a cab in Philadelphia, my taxi garage was next to a pork slaughterhouse. And one morning on my way into work, I happened to see a guy from the slaughterhouse unloading a truck full of live, squealing pigs. I watched him repeatedly rear back and kick the pigs so hard the truck bed would shudder. Decades later, I still recall that image, and I remember thinking how I'd hate that job and how cruel the man's behavior was. My guest, writer Eyal Press, has a new book about some of the people in America who work in jobs that most of us would run from because they're punishing and difficult and are seen in some way as morally compromised. He interviewed prison mental health workers and correctional officers, oil rig workers, slaughterhouse employees, and military drone operators. He writes that these workers often do jobs that many of us believe we benefit from in the form of lower prices, safer streets, or cheaper energy, but don't really much want to think about. The work tends to fall to people with fewer opportunities, he writes, and when we hear about ill effects associated with these jobs, like COVID infections from poultry slaughterhouses or inhumane treatment of the incarcerated, we often condemn the workers rather than the exploitative system in which they work. Eyal Press writes for The New Yorker and other publications. He's the author of two previous books. He joined us on Fresh Air in 2006 to talk about one of them, Absolute Convictions. And as of this spring, he is a sociologist with a PhD from New York University. His new book is called Dirty Work, Essential Jobs and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. Well, Eyal Press, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much.
You write about mental health workers and correctional officers. And, you know, people who study this issue know that we have far fewer residential mental institutions than we had in this country decades ago. And there's a shortage of community mental health alternatives. So a lot of people with mental health issues, particularly poor people, end up incarcerated. You write about a woman, a mental health counselor at the Dade Correctional Institution in Florida. Just tell us a little about her and what her job was.
So yeah, her name is Harriet Krzyzkowski, and Harriet got a job as a mental health aide at the Dade Correctional Institution in Florida, just south of Miami, shortly after the Great Recession. And she had never worked in corrections before, really didn't know what to expect. And as she started working the job, she began hearing stories about patients entrusted to her care in the mental health ward of the prison, which was called the Transitional Care Unit, being mistreated. Some of them complained that they weren't getting food, their meals were being skipped. She witnessed verbal abuse that concerned her. And gradually, she learned that this abuse was both systemic and severe. And so I wanted to kind of go into what do you do if you're a mental health aide at a prison like that, when on the one hand, your job is to care for the patients. On the other hand, you're beholden to the security at the facility.
Right. She was making $12 an hour when she started. Is that right?
That's right. She was making $12 an hour, and she really needed the job. And she went into it thinking of herself as allied with the security at the prison. But early on, Harriet noticed that she wanted to, one of her jobs, one of her responsibilities was to allow the prisoners into the rec yard. And when they weren't allowed in repeatedly, she mentioned this to her supervisor. And the supervisor proceeded to tell her, our job is to get along with security. And shortly after this incident, she started noticing that guards would leave suddenly when she was doing, say, group sessions or on one occasion when she was in the rec yard. And that was a kind of message, you know, don't cross us, don't be on the wrong side of things.
So she felt like there was mistreatment, or it certainly concerns about mistreatment, but if she complained, she felt like she would at times be in a vulnerable position, that correctional officers would deliberately leave her with inmates in circumstances that made her fear for her safety. Did she ever have anything happen to her that, as a result of that?
She did indeed. I recount an incident in the book where she was in the rec yard alone, and a prisoner came up to her. He was quite psychotic, and he touched her inappropriately. And she froze, not knowing what to do, and really feared anything could happen at that point because she was alone. She ended up leaving and sort of backing away quickly, and nothing happened. But as she later told me, she was deeply, deeply shaken, as one would expect, and felt, you know, anything could have happened there. I could have been sexually assaulted. I could have lost my life. And so that really shaped how she proceeded to react to other things she would learn.
So the correctional officers didn't tell her this. They didn't threaten her, right? It was simply delivered by, the message was delivered directly by leaving her alone at times.
That's right. And it was a sort of, you know, message of what we say goes, don't cross us. Don't, you know, do something that gets us in trouble. Your job here is to adhere to our rules, not to try to alter the way we do things, including with your patients.
So there were cases of prisoners not getting meals, not getting exercise that was required. There were some really much more serious cases of abuse too, weren't there?
That's right. And this all kind of unfolded in real time for Harriet. She didn't know how bad it was. So one day at work, Harriet came in and she heard that a prisoner in the mental health ward named Darren Rainey had defecated in his cell and was refusing to clean it up. And when she asked one of the guards, what's going on with Rainey? The guard assured her, don't worry about him. We're going to take him to a shower to clean him up. And Harriet actually found that reassuring. The next day she came in and she heard from a nurse that Rainey had indeed been taken to a shower, but that he had not made it out of the shower alive. And when Harriet first heard this, she thought, he must have had a heart attack, maybe it was a suicide. And the nurse told her, no, he was taken to a shower and deliberately locked inside of it. And in this particular shower, both the water flow and temperature of the water was controlled from the outside by the guards. And that water temperature was 180 degrees, which is hot enough to brew a cup of tea. And Rainey collapsed in that shower and died. Autopsy reports later showed that he suffered burns on about 90% of his body. And indeed, other prisoners have testified and recalled that they heard Rainey screaming that night, that he couldn't take this. And so Harriet learns all of this. She's in shock. She feels, as she told me, that someone has to report this. But she doesn't want to be the person to report it because she feared that that will get her in trouble with the guards. And indeed, she doesn't report it. And no one on the mental health staff reports it.
I should note that one reason that we know a lot of details about this is that a Miami Herald reporter, Julie K. Brown, who covered a lot of stuff in prisons, wrote about this case and exposed a lot of this. So how did Harriet Kruskowski deal with this? What effect did it have on her?
She was shocked, she was horrified, but she was also scared. And she, on the one hand, wanted to say something and to report what she learned, because no one who hears that, has, you know, any concern for suffering, is going to want to stay silent. But she did stay silent, and she stayed silent because she had learned from those earlier experiences that you don't cross the guards at this facility without paying a price for it. And so suddenly Harriet is in this position where, as she put it to me, the lesson was don't be a witness and don't say anything. And in fact, no one on the mental health staff did say anything. The only reason that we know about this case and that Julie Brown at the Miami Herald reported on it was that a prisoner at the prison named Harold Hempstead, he spoke out about it, but the staff did not.
So Harriet Kruskowski comes in and wants to help people, right? And she clearly sees people who have mental health issues, a lot of them who need help. She can't do this, and she learns of these abuses. She feels, you know, hamstrung from doing anything. What was the effect on her emotionally?
It was pretty drastic. And I should say that at the very beginning, Harriet did want to help people, but she also just needed a job. And she was frank with me about the fact that if she could have gotten another job, she would have. And that's kind of a theme in the book, that these are sort of jobs of last resort. They're not aspirational positions, and it wasn't for Harriet. But she came to see the humanity in the people she was entrusted to care for. And because she stayed silent, she stopped eating. She lost her appetite. She started losing her hair. She became depressed. She didn't tell anyone what she was going through. In fact, even her family members didn't know much of what was going on. Her husband, but she just really fell into a psychic malaise, and later, would be diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder from the kind of psychic and emotional toll that this took on her.
You spoke to some prison guards. One of them, in particular, a guy named Bill Curtis. He worked at a different prison. He came in. He wasn't young. He was a veteran, and he actually had been a boxer, you note. What did his experience lead him to conclude about the conduct of guards in prisons?
Well, Bill Curtis indeed is someone I spoke to at length, and his story is described in the book. And I think like a lot of corrections officers, he felt the system is tilted in favor of the prisoners, not the prison guards. That we always get the blame, and we don't deserve it. And to some extent, the kind of sentiment you would expect to hear from someone in this position. But he also had some other views that would surprise readers, I think. Bill actually kept a diary while he worked. And in it, he would describe what he called serial bullies. And these were fellow officers who he watched abuse prisoners viciously. I mean, with just real, real cruelty. He did not mince words about that. He sees this as deplorable, and he said so to me. But then again, he complicated things as well, because he said, the people of Florida get what they pay for from their corrections officers. And what he meant was, here you have officers who have received very little training or no training in how to deal with people with severe mental illnesses, who are working in institutions where the budgets are pared down. There are fewer and fewer services. There's fewer and fewer staff members and in many facilities, working longer hours. And so how do you enforce order in such an institution, he asked me. He said, well, it's very simple. What an officer learns is you do it through force. You do it through brute force. And I learned that lesson, and others learned that lesson. And so in a sense, what he's saying is, everybody wants to blame us. And yet what we do is, if not quietly condoned, all but inevitable, given the conditions in so many jails and prisons in the state of Florida, which has, at the time of Rainey's death, had the third largest prison system in the country, and spent next to last on mental health services per capita.
Based on your interviews as well as other research you've done, how do correctional officers feel about their occupation? How does it make them feel about themselves?
Well, I think that in my interviews and in the literature on corrections officers, what you find in many places is that they feel, boy, I wish I could have been a cop or a firefighter. I'm doing this job because I get benefits, and that's the only reason. Or I'm doing this job because I don't want to do a job that is temporary and I can't support my family. Certainly the studies suggest this is, again, not a career that people aspire to have. It's a job they end up doing after a kind of period of occupational drift, or because they have few other better choices. And I should say that the geography of prisons and jails in this country sort of helps reinforce that. Many of the prisons and jails in the United States have been built in more low-income rural areas where the good jobs that used to exist, the mills and factories, shut down. So what replaced them? Jails and prisons.
Right. And it's one of the points you make in the book that in correctional institutions and some of the other jobs that you talk about, they tend to be isolated from population centers, which can also lead to a lack of accountability.
Absolutely. And I think a running theme in the book and really in all the jobs that I looked at was that there's an element of hiding. So, what I mean when I say dirty work is work that society, in a sense, depends on and tacitly condones, but doesn't want to hear too much about and certainly doesn't want to see. And on one level, the walls around jails and prisons achieve that, and those walls exist in every society. So you're not getting daily information about what goes on inside. But the geography also reinforces that, and I think the class dimension. So we push these facilities out of sight, out of mind. And indeed, in Florida, I had to drive around a lot to find the prisons that I wanted to see and to visit and to talk to people at. They're not near the golf resorts and the beach, the oceanfront states and all of that. And that division, I think, is deliberate.
We spend a lot of time at the jobs that we work at, and we often talk about our work, among coworkers and to others. It's an important part of your experience. If you work in a place that you feel bad about or you feel unsafe in, you're probably a lot less likely to talk about it. Did you find this among prison guards?
I mean, I think that's certainly true. I think it's really hard to get people to talk. And I should say that in the case of Dade, I didn't just talk to Harriet. I talked to several other people, many of whom had gone through equally difficult experiences. One woman who witnessed a stomping incident where a group of guards stomped on a prisoner who was badly, badly injured. And she said to me, I wanted to scream. I wanted to do something, but I didn't even report it. And I said nothing about it because I needed my job. And this was, a Puerto Rican woman who was surviving as a consequence of the work she did. So, I think there's reluctance, which is compounded by a kind of dependence, that if this is your livelihood. But I should also say that there are plenty of people, both guards and mental health aides, who would probably tell you, I have no trouble at all with my job. I don't see it as troubled. I don't see it as troubling. I'm not stressed out by it. And what I find really interesting about that, I took a tour of a jail in Colorado at one point when I was researching this subject. And the warden said to me, the guys I worry about are not the guys who tell me this is a really hard and stressful job. It's the guys who never say that and who say they're totally fine with it.
Explain it. What do you mean? I mean, what do the ones who don't complain do?
Well, I mean, so if you look at the occupational health literature on prison guards, you have alarming rates of hypertension, of divorce, depression, substance abuse, suicide. One study that found, the suicide risk among corrections workers was 39% higher than for the rest of the working age population. So somewhere that stress and that the some kind of emotional and psychic toll is playing out. It may not be verbalized as, oh, I'm distressed by this job, but I don't think that means it's not there. And indeed, in the chapter on corrections officers, I also talked to a woman who ended up setting up a mental health hotline and then a kind of outreach center. It's called the Desert Waters Correctional Outreach Center. And because she kept getting calls from the partners of corrections officers in this area of Colorado that is just full of prisons and jails, saying, I'm concerned about my partner. And she got so many of these calls, and her own background was in treating trauma victims, that she thought, this is a traumatic job. This is a really high risk, potentially traumatizing job. I think what's really difficult is to measure and quantify the kinds of psychic and emotional wounds that doing a job like this has. But that doesn't mean those wounds are not there, and it doesn't mean they're not debilitating.
We need to take another break here. Let me reintroduce you. We're speaking with Eyal Press. He writes for The New Yorker and other publications and is the author of two previous books. His new book is Dirty Work, Essential Jobs and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. He'll be back to talk more after this break. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
Our guest is journalist and author Eyal Press. His new book is about jobs in America that many of us benefit from, but most of us wouldn't want because they're difficult and in some way morally compromised. He interviewed prison mental health workers and correctional officers, oil rig workers, slaughterhouse employees, and military drone operators. The book is called Dirty Work, Essential Jobs and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. How did you get into this subject? What made you want to write about it?
Well, my last book, Beautiful Souls, was about individuals who, when faced with really morally difficult situations, ended up heeding the voice of conscience and, in a sense, keeping their hands clean. So I wrote about, you know, soldiers who refused unjust orders. I wrote about a police captain in Switzerland who was told to keep Jews from crossing into Switzerland who were trying to escape Nazism, and he let them in. And so it was the sort of stories of moral courage and how people find the courage to act that way in the face of all this risk. But as I was doing that research on that book, I kept reading about and meeting people who hadn't, you know, stopped and kept their hands clean in these situations, who had gone along. And I was struck both by the power of their stories, the wounds that seemed apparent in just the way they spoke about what they'd been through, and they didn't always do so freely, and also just the fact that in a way, that's the more common story. You know, I wrote about the exceptional people who do find their courage in these situations, and I felt, you know, there's another story, and maybe a larger story, about the people who go along, the kind of conflicted insiders, or what Primo Levi called the gray, ambiguous persons, who are really all of us, who go along in these situations. And then I also started thinking about who in our society is put in those positions.
You know, as I read the book, it struck me that in any industrial society where there is a division of labor, there will certainly be jobs that nobody wants. And I did a lot of blue-collar employment when I was earlier on, and it struck me that friends I had who, you know, had kind of grown up in more affluent circumstances and had no idea where all the stuff that they use in their lives comes from. I don't mean they literally had no idea, but what it takes to actually make, you know, our clothes and the homes and businesses that we work in and appliances and all those stuff. That blue-collar work, people factory work, is dirty and hard and physically demanding and often unsafe, but we generally don't know about it. And I think that's sort of true generally. I mean, we don't think about a lot of jobs that we don't spend time with.
Absolutely. No, and I think that, you know, to some extent that's inevitable in any society and a society as large as ours. On the other hand, I think, to me at least, there's something unsettling about that, about the ease with which those who rely on and use and burn fossil fuels and fill up their gas tanks can do all of that and at the same time not feel implicated in the, you know, dirty work of fracking and drilling and dirty and dangerous. That if we think about the industrial food system, you know, as folks like Michael Pollan have said, we're, as a society, more removed perhaps than any other people in history from the industrial food system that churns out the cheap meat we consume and eat. And so at a certain point, you can say it's inevitable, but there are also questions about what that does to us and what it means on a moral level.
One of the occupations you look at is kind of different from the others. You talk to people who were military drone operators who analyzed intelligence from drones. They're involved, you say, in what can be called remote killing. First of all, where do these people do this? What are their shifts like?
So they do this at places like the Creech Air Force Base. And again, to go back to the theme of not easy places for the public to access. You know, the drone program is swathed in secrecy and takes place on military bases in our country, but accessed only by those who work inside.
You write about a guy named Christopher Aaron who had done this work. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, Chris Aaron, who's one of the former drone operators I write about at length. You know, he was someone who after 9/11 felt a streak of idealism kind of derived from his grandfather who had served in World War II. He said, you know, I want to go serve my country. He ends up very early on helping out and working on the drone program. And in the beginning, he doesn't feel very conflicted about what he's doing. What he remembered and what he described was the sort of exhilaration, in a sense, of, you know, oh, we got a high target, you know, high five. There's just this sense that we're getting the bad guys. And then after a couple of sort of, they're not really tours, but I would say just serving in the drone program and doing a couple of stints, Chris is sort of mulling a career of doing this, and he starts to have a physical breakdown. And this is, you know, he's a very fit guy, never, you know, was a wrestler in high school, and he starts to develop skin welts and feel sick and just feel weak. He can't get out of bed. That leads into a kind of set of emotional problems that are equally intense. He becomes depressed, lifeless, and he was this, you know, incredibly, you know, strikingly vigorous person. And it's at this point, as he's sort of going through all of this, that he's realizing he's starting to question what he's doing.
We're going to take another break here. I'm going to reintroduce you. We're speaking with A.L. Press. He writes for The New Yorker and other publications. His new book is Dirty Work, Essential Jobs and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. We'll continue our conversation after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, inviting you to check out our new online archive, collecting 40 years of Fresh Air interviews and reviews. You can hear my interviews with people like David Bowie, Aretha Franklin, Johnny Cash, John Updike, Toni Morrison. Search for names you're interested in. Make a playlist for yourself or friends at freshairarchive.org. That's freshairarchive.org.
So help us understand, either through Chris Aaron's experiences or others, I mean, these guys sit at these terminals, and in sometimes they're analyzing visual images. In some cases, they're actually piloting drones, but what sorts of images do they see? What do they see about the impact of military strikes that can be troubling?
What we're learning is that intelligence analysts and officers who are involved and sitting at in what are called remote combat operations are actually seeing graphic violence, homes destroyed, villages bombed, bodies burned, more than even, you know, special forces on the ground. You know, I think in the beginning, there was this sort of assumption that folks in those situations, because they're sitting at a desk and they're distant, and that this is like playing a video game. What's the big deal, right? It would foster what one person called a PlayStation mentality to killing, which is its own concern, and indeed was the concern among critics of drones. But what the military is finding, and in part because of the burnout rates and the sort of surveys and studies that I cite in the book, is that a lot of folks are experiencing grief and sadness and what are called negative disruptive emotions really intensely. And to get back to Chris, you know, he was really overwhelmed by those feelings. And he started wondering, you know, wait a minute, were those high fives, am I sure we got the bad guys in those strikes? And I should say that those questions arose very specifically after he was in Afghanistan and felt like not only was the war not going the way he'd been told, things were getting worse on the ground. And we're talking in a week when Afghanistan is obviously very much in the news. And, you know, one of the things I talk about in the book is moral injury. And Jonathan Shea, the psychologist who coined the term, says that moral injury begins with betrayal, that the people who do the killing and the fighting and the sacrificing feel betrayed by the society and the commanders who told them, your mission is this, and then they start to question that and wonder.
You mentioned Creech Air Force Base in Nevada. Is that the one where there are 900 drone pilots and sensor and analysts?
That's right. That's right. And when I visited Creech, you know, one of the things that struck me is that although as a society, you often hear kind of flippant, you know, yeah, it's the PlayStation mentality. That's not the approach there at all. And in fact, you know, the team of sort of therapists and psychologists that I spoke to at Creech were very frank about the fact that this is in its own way a stressful and difficult and morally difficult kind of combat, because the people doing it, one former Marine in particular, it struck me when he said, you know, when you're on the ground, there's esprit de corps, you know, you're fighting for your fellow soldiers and you feel that camaraderie. Here, the operators are getting in their cars afterwards and driving home, often alone, to a society that has kind of forgotten that we are fighting these wars. You know, so they get text messages, you know, pick up the milk on the way home or pick up someone from soccer practice. That's an incredibly jarring difference. And it speaks to how, you know, disengaged as a society we've become from the wars that are fought in our name. But I think that for people at places like Creech, it's particularly intense.
And it's just so odd that someone who does this work, I mean, it's secret. I mean, people who are uniformed servicemen and women, when we see them, regardless of how we might feel about the particular war or conflict they're involved in, we respect their service. And that's sort of generally acknowledged in society. I mean, in the case of drone war, I mean, it's essentially unacknowledged by the government a lot of the time. You know, the victims, you know, are never publicized. And so they really have to carry this around themselves sort of anonymously.
Yeah, I think the anonymous part of it is a big piece of what could make it difficult. I think there's another piece. You know, people who serve in combat missions on the ground, there's a valor to that. That's the traditional heroic narrative we tell about war. People risking and sacrificing, facing the enemy. What happens when you kill, but you're not facing those risks and danger? And I don't think it's an accident that when the military tried to introduce a kind of valor medal for drone operators, some within the military mocked it as a kind of Nintendo medal, which, you know, suggests, you know, hey, why should we give a medal to people who haven't even done this kind of, you know, haven't put their lives on the line? And yet, as a society, we have come to fight a lot of, you know, to do a lot of this drone warfare because we don't want the sacrifice, right? We don't want more casualties piling up in these what have become very unpopular wars. So to get back to that thing of you're doing exactly what society has asked you to do for the drone operators, you know, distance killing without risk to our side, zero risk to our side, at least in terms of getting shells in return, that's exactly what they're being asked to do. That seemed like a good thing. But, you know, if it's stripped of valor and it's anonymous and you have to live with the uncertainty of what it's all doing, it can be, I think, extremely stressful and troubling.
You know, you describe a remarkable service that you witnessed at a VA medical center in Philadelphia involving, you know, a former combatant. Can you just share this with us?
Sure. So I went down to the VA medical center and one evening attended this amazing ceremony. It took place in a chapel inside the VA Medical Center, where veterans who have experienced moral injury and who have fought in America's recent wars came forward to talk about their experiences. But they didn't just come forward to talk among themselves. They each had invited members of the community to listen. And so in the particular ceremony I attended, there was a veteran named Andy who spoke, and he began by talking about how he went into the military to protect the defenseless. He had kind of grown up in a violent home, and he's in Iraq one night in the Sunni Triangle, and there's a burst of gunfire from a window. He calls in, he calls air, which means delivering the strike, and the strike is delivered, and when the smoke clears, he sees the bodies of civilians. There's no target inside. There are men, women, and children. I believe there were 36 in all. So the ceremony could have ended there, and it would have been haunting and powerful just on its own. But there was a next step, and the next step was the folks in the audience came forward, and they formed a circle around the veterans who had just spoken, including Andy, who's sobbing as he tells us what he's seen. And they link arms, and they say in unison, "We sent you into harm's way. We put you into situations where atrocities were possible. We share responsibility with you for all that you have seen, for all that you have done, for all that you have failed to do."
That's powerful. Do you know whether how Andy or the other ex-combatants felt about it? Did it make a difference?
I think that it did make a difference. In fact, I was recently in touch with the minister who runs that program at the VA Medical Center, and he told me Andy's doing well. And, you know, I have no firsthand knowledge of that. But if it is indeed the case, it tells you something about what the difference is between keeping all of this dirty work hidden and having the people who do it sort through it on their own, and the opposite approach, which is to communalize it and, in a sense, to all take responsibility for it and look it in the face and say, okay, this is what is being done in our name.
You know, I'm wondering how the COVID pandemic, which has, I think for a lot of us, made us more aware of how we rely on certain people to come to their jobs at a time when there may be risk, how that's affected this, affected your thinking about this, affected our awareness of people doing dirty work.
I think that we're halfway there. I think the pandemic has definitely made all of us aware of how much we depend. When I say we, I mean anyone who's been sheltering in place or getting groceries delivered to their door, of what, you know, the delivery drivers do and the grocery clerks and the people who had to go to work at the height of the pandemic, risking their safety and their physical safety. Where I don't think we've gotten a similar awareness, and this is why I wrote the book, is in terms of the moral division of labor, how we also have an even more hidden class of workers who do these morally troubling things that are pretty central to our society. You know, you talked about, I talked about slaughterhouses and you know, pumping oil into the gas tank. There's also the gadgets in our hands, where there's a chapter in the book called Dirty Tech, where I go into, you know, some of the morally compromising things that happen to put cobalt into ion batteries that charge these devices. I don't think we have a similar awareness of that. But I do think that this is a moment where we're all thinking about how workers who are hidden and who pay the price, both physically and emotionally and in other ways, how we depend on them.
Well, A.L. Prest, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me on the program.
A.L. Prest writes for The New Yorker and other publications and is the author of two previous books. His new book is Dirty Work: Essential Jobs and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. Coming up, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Laura Lippman's new thriller, which deals with the issue of literary theft. This is Fresh Air.
This message is brought to you by NPR sponsor Talkspace. Feeling overwhelmed lately? You're not alone. We all need a little help sometimes. And asking for support is a sign of strength. Talkspace online therapy matches you with a licensed therapist from the comfort of your device to help you start feeling better with a single message. Match with a licensed therapist and get $100 off your first month with code FRESHAIR at Talkspace.com.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Marcus by Goldman Sachs, who believes that you can money. Marcus by Goldman Sachs Invest now offers digitally managed portfolios built by over 150 years of Goldman Sachs experience. Find out more about their digitally managed portfolios as well as their other products today at Marcus.com. Brokerage advisory services by Goldman Sachs and Company, LLC, member SIPC. Investments involve risk and may lose value.
There's much to be anxious about these days, from the Delta variant to events in Afghanistan. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan has read a lot of so-called beach books this summer, including Laura Lippman's recent Dream Girl, and has found that many are filled with an anxiety specific to writers about a very literary form of theft. Here's Maureen's review.
Something strange is afoot in mystery and suspense fiction. The plot of almost every thriller I've read in the past 6 months has had something to do with one character stealing the story of another character and passing it off as their own. The rundown includes The Plot by Jean Hanf Korelitz, A Lonely Man by Chris Power, The Other Black Girl by Zakiya Dalila Harris, Palace of the Drowned by Christine Mangan, and A Slow Fire Burning, the forthcoming novel by Paula Hawkins. Worry over manuscripts falling into the wrong hands is nothing new in mystery fiction. After all, Edgar Allan Poe, the acknowledged father of the form, relied on that plot for his 1844 short story, The Purloined Letter. But this year's crop of mystery and suspense novels puts a socially conscious spin on the missing manuscript tale. They're about the anxiety of appropriation, about one character in a position of privilege in terms of gender, financial security, or race, laying their sticky mitts on the writing or life story of another character who's not so advantaged. The plot of Laura Lippman's latest standalone suspense novel, Dream Girl, arises not only out of this anxiety about who gets to tell whose stories, but also out of the Me Too movement. And it also owes a lot to Stephen King's 1987 horror classic, Misery, altogether making Dream Girl the ideal, cutting-edge, socially conscious entertainment for late summer. Dream Girl is set in the penthouse of a lofty eyesore of a luxury high-rise in Baltimore, Lippman's hometown and the site of most of her novels. We savvy readers sense that something is off from the opening description of famous novelist Gerry Anderson's lavish digs. Lippman's narrator tells us that Gerry Anderson's new apartment is a topsy-turvy affair, living area on the second floor, bedrooms below. The brochure, it is the kind of apartment that had its own brochure when it went on the market in 2018, boasted of 360-degree views, but that was pure hype. Nothing means anything anymore, Gerry has decided. No one uses words correctly, and if you call them on it, they claim that words are fungible, that it's oppressive and prissy not to let words mean whatever the speaker wishes them to mean. Isn't this delicious? A cranky novelist ensconced in a swanky setting, railing at the idiocies of the contemporary world. As Lippman imagines him, Gerry owes something to Philip Roth, as well as to Roth's fictional alter ego, Nathan Zuckerman. There's the brilliance, the wit, the complicated sexual history with women, and the fraught relationship with his own mother. But at the end of the first chapter, Gerry, the literary lion in winter, is taken down, literally. He stumbles over the rowing machine in his bedroom, skids to the edge of the floating staircase that connects the floors of the duplex, windmills down the steps, and lands at the bottom, a crooked, broken thing. There, he lies alone throughout the night until his young assistant, Victoria, arrives in the morning. For months, Gerry will be imprisoned in that penthouse, his only constant visitors, Victoria, and a night nurse named Aileen. During that time, Gerry will be tormented by dead-of-night phone calls from a woman who claims to be the person whose story Gerry stole for his breakthrough novel, also called Dream Girl. Whenever the phone rings, Aileen claims she doesn't hear it. In his medicated state, Gerry can barely think straight. Is he being gaslighted? Think Stephen King's Misery, starring Zuckerman, Bound. With each standalone novel she writes, Lippman veers off in a different direction. Sunburn was a sexy noir, winking at James M. Cain. Lady in the Lake, a historical crime story, winked even more broadly at Raymond Chandler. And now Lipman has poked a toe into horror. The source of the jitters here is that very high rise Jerry is marooned in. Lipman's series detective, Tess Monahan, makes a cameo when Jerry tries to hire her. Tess turns up at Jerry's place and ultimately turns the job down. As she explains, the reason is the penthouse itself. "I couldn't spend a lot of time in this apartment," Tess says. "Maybe it's like the Spielberg movie, where it turns out a grave has been desecrated. Only the thing that's buried beneath your beautiful apartment is jobs. There were silos here, grain silos. There were jobs all over this peninsula. This place gives me the creeps, big time. I could never do surveillance here." Packed with social criticism, satire, ghosts, and narrative turns of the screw, Lipman's Dream Girl is indeed a dream of a novel. And all the literary pilferings Lipman herself has committed here are acknowledged, front and center.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Dream Girl by Laura Lipman. On tomorrow's show, we'll explore the reasons for the Taliban's sweeping victory in Afghanistan and consider future prospects for the country with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and New Yorker staff writer Steve Call. He's written two books dealing with U.S. involvement in Afghanistan and the role of Pakistan in the conflict. I hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Saman, Teresa Madden, and Marie Baldonado, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Kayla Lattimore. Our producer of digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.